From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Toxic world. Over 100 nations are negotiating a treaty banning the world's deadliest chemicals. We'll speak with activists from some of the world's toxic hotspots, from Cancer Alley in Louisiana to abandoned U.S. military bases in the Philippines. Also, the European Union orders the slaughter of millions of cows and bans animal-based feed as mad cow disease spreads to several countries. Is U.S. beef safe? We'll hear from both sides of the issue. And a debate over immigration as Congress considers an amnesty for undocumented immigrants. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers for Vice President Gore and Governor George Bush must file briefs today with the Florida Supreme Court, which is expected to speak the final word on the disputed Florida ballots. Oral arguments will begin tomorrow, and the court could rule as early as the end of the week. Gore's challenge to Florida's certification of a Bush victory was summarily rejected by Leon County Circuit Judge N. Sanders Sauls on Monday, only hours after the U.S. Supreme Court sent back to the Florida Supreme Court for clarification a ruling extending the state certification deadline so hand recounting of votes could be tallied. Meanwhile, a separate trial is getting underway today in which Democrats in Seminole County are attempting to have 15,000 absentee ballots thrown out in the heavily Republican county, a move that would give Gore a lead of up to 5,000 votes statewide, enough to win the presidency. Lawyers for Seminole plaintiff Harry Jacobs say the ballots should be tossed out because Republican workers were allowed to fill out voter identification numbers on more than 2,000 incomplete absentee ballot applications sent in by Republican voters. At the same time, lawyers allege County Election Supervisor Gore refused to allow Democratic workers to do the same thing for Democratic voters. Gore is not a party to the lawsuit. Texas broke the national record for executions in a year last night when it put to death Gary Miller, accused of murdering a 7-year-old girl. The lethal injection gave Texas 38 executions this year, the most by any state since U.S. authorities began keeping death penalty records in 1930. The Environmental Protection Agency plans to order the General Electric Company today to spend $500 million to dredge toxic PCBs embedded in the mud beneath the Hudson River in what would be the most ambitious river cleanup in the nation's history. After 10 years of studies, the EPA concluded that unless the PCBs are removed, they will continue to elevate the risks of cancer and other health problems above acceptable levels. The plan is a major defeat for GE, which owns the factories that dumped the chemicals in the river over a 30-year period. GE said it will fight the plan with every resource available and has already begun a recent media blitz to encourage doubts about the dredging. The EPA must take into account public comments before making its final decision in June. In other health news, a scientific advisory panel to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has found that there's a, quote, medium likelihood that the genetically engineered Starlink corn is a potential food allergen. It notes children may be more sensitive than adults and suggested a study of infant diets be given high priority. It also recommended a study of people who claim to have suffered adverse effect from eating the corn as the highest priority. Starlink, developed by France's Aventis, has only been approved for animal consumption in the U.S. because of questions over allergic reactions in humans, but has been found in large amounts of corn. The refusal of Delta Airlines pilots to work overtime pending contract negotiations has forced the U.S. carrier to cancel 3% to 5% of its daily flights. Contract negotiations began last September, but have stalled. Hoping to ease the high cost of living in Silicon Valley, Santa Clara County approved an unprecedented plan yesterday to use its share of the national tobacco settlement to provide health coverage for all uninsured children in the county. The county of more than 1.7 million residents is believed to have 69,000 children without health care. On January 2nd, officials will begin enrolling children in the program, which is expected to cost $14 million a year. It'll cover families making up to three times the federal poverty level, meaning a family of four with income of nearly $52,000 is eligible. Most state and federal programs are aimed at people making less than half that amount. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on Monday that the University of Washington Law School acted legally when it considered the race of applicants in its now-abandoned admissions policy. The decision means that publicly funded schools throughout the circuit, which includes most Western states, can continue to use affirmative action programs. And Utah's teachers staged a one-day walkout yesterday to protest crowded classrooms, low per-student spending, and tattered textbooks.
It ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County if you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County. It don't matter anyhow. When you look to the right of your candidate's name, and the hole and the arrow ain't lined up the same, maybe you're just a little off with your aim. Punch it twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe, like you never done before. No, it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. There's no way you can vote for Gore. This butterfly ballot was designed just for you, 'cause you're old and liberal and a Jew. Been voting Democratic since 1932. Just punch it twice, it's all right.
Ross Altman singing Punch It Twice, It's All Right. You can get more information on that song by going to Grey Goose Music at AOL.com here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, speaking of which, Justice Department representatives arrived in Florida yesterday to look into allegations that some African Americans were deprived of their right to vote in the presidential election. The NAACP has been pressing the Justice Department since the November 7th election to investigate complaints of voting irregularities in Florida. The civil rights group says it's gathered 486 complaints and taken more than 300 pages of sworn testimony from people who say they were blocked from voting. Yesterday, in a question and answer session with the media, Vice President Al Gore was asked about these complaints.
What are your thoughts about the black votes being discounted there?
Excuse me, say that what?
The black votes that were discounted. Reverend Jesse Jackson and the NAACP are saying the black votes were discounted in Florida as well.
I am very troubled by a lot of the stories that have been reported about a roadblock on the way to one precinct, questions raised about various activities there. I do not have any personal or firsthand knowledge of those events, but whenever there are problems of that kind alleged, they are deserving of attention.
Well, will you meet with Jesse Jackson?
I talk with him regularly, of course, and I have worked with him closely. I've spoken with Kwaisi Umfume and Julian Bond, Penn DeHare, who is ahead of the efforts by the NAACP against voter suppression, has been in touch with our people. But I have no knowledge of those activities. I want to say to you clearly that, in my opinion, whenever you have allegations of those kind, that is a matter that the entire country ought to take seriously. They are not part of the ongoing court action, and I don't want to mislead you on that, but certainly want you to know that I think that they're serious allegations.
Mr. President, yeah. Last question.
The vice president speaking yesterday in a question and answer period. Many are asking why a Voting Rights Act civil lawsuit has not yet been filed, though it said the NAACP is working on it. And as Vice President Gore, around the time he was talking to the press inside with the help from an aide inside the Capitol, Senator Strom Thurmond slowly walked to the dais, banged the gavel, and opened a lame duck session of the Senate yesterday, his 98th birthday. As the Senate President Pro Tem, Thurman is third in line of succession for the presidency, and his health and mental alertness have been questioned in the past year. In a telephone interview Monday with a South Carolina newspaper, Thurman said he was turning 88. He was corrected by an aide in the background, turning 98. Last week, he told a reporter he might quit 3 or 4 months before his term ends in January 2003 so his wife Nancy could take over his seat. The couple separated in 1991. Strom Thurmond ran as a segregationist for president in 1948. He now in the Senate, will move into a Senate that has no African Americans or Latinos. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we look at the issue of immigration. White House officials and Republican congressional leaders are nearing an agreement on a proposed amnesty for around 1 million undocumented immigrants who've been in the country at least 15 years. But they remain divided over President Clinton's proposal to include more refugees from Haiti and Central America. Members of the Hispanic caucus met yesterday with the president's team to push for the amnesty. The thorniest problem remains a Democratic proposal to offer permanent residence to refugees from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Haiti. The goal is to achieve parity with Cuban and Nicaraguan refugees who face an easier threshold to become permanent residents. Republicans, led by Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, oppose the measure. This decision will be especially felt on the border with Mexico, where beefed-up controls by the Border Patrol, the INS, and the National Guard continue to affect people's everyday lives. Hundreds of people are gathering this week on the border in Douglas, Arizona, for a major human rights conference. Among those is Isabel Garcia, attorney and director of Pima County Legal Defender's Office, speaking to us from Douglas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Isabel Garcia.
Good morning. I'm talking to you from Tucson.
From Tucson. Tell us, what is at issue in Congress now?
Well, for us, we believe that in addition to the very important pieces of legislation dealing with amnesty, dealing with the Central American situation, those of us at the border intend to press upon the Congress to reevaluate a border policy that is resulting in the deaths of hundreds along the border and record number of deaths. And so for us, we will not be satisfied alone with the issue of amnesty and dealing, of course, with the problems that immigrants face once they're in the country. But we are going to very deliberately and very openly really begin to question in a big way the public policy that is militarizing this border as we speak. Day before yesterday, they brought in 20 soldiers as part of Joint Task Force 6 to continue with their, quote, reinforcement of the border. If people could see photographs of what that means, they would think we are at war with Mexico. And so for us, that is a human rights crisis that we are facing and that we will continue to face, because this new fence, this wall, this steel-matted wall, is being extended another 2 miles in Douglas. For us and for the immigrants, that means that they have absolutely no way to receive any kind of human assistance, no way to be near an urban or a town, urbanized area or a town, and in fact, they've got to trek out 4 or 5 miles into the desert, into the mountains, where they face their death, and sometimes they face hostile ranchers and other folks. And so for us, that's going to be a key issue that we intend to bring to Congress.
Speaking of the wall, there's a call from the Department of Prisons to build more prisons in southern Arizona and California to hold undocumented border crossers, many of them referred to as low-security criminal aliens. Can you talk about this?
Yes, in fact, we have recently been apprised that there is a proposition, a resolution in the town of Wilcox. I mean, yes, we've got small communities, small towns that have economic, they're economically repressed, and so they feel that when there's federal dollars dangling, and this is a very difficult situation for us, when they dangle huge federal dollars, of course, the community, the politicians, of course, in particular, are very eager to attempt to have those built in those communities. But we are also very concerned with the growth, of course, of the prison industry as a whole. As a criminal defense attorney, I am very alarmed at the growing rate of the prisons across the country. But in particular, in regards to this issue, we're very concerned about these joint operations between Bureau of Prisons and these private corporations and INS that are coming together to build more and more prisons to house more and more Mexicanos in particular. This is an alarming situation for us. We are criminalizing whole sectors of our community. Anybody who's undocumented and is caught and is charged with illegal entries, illegal reentries, false papers, transporting an undocumented person that can be your companions or your family members, and on and on. We have a whole slate of criminal immigration violations that are just flooding the federal district courts and system along the border. And, of course, responding to that a burgeoning caseload of new criminals, we need new prisons. That's what they believe, that we need new prisons. And so we believe it's an alarming situation, and we hope to address those issues as well at our summit this coming weekend.
Isabel Garcia, attorney and director of the Pima County Legal Defender's Office, speaking to us from Tucson. Rick Allman also joins us, Western Field Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, known as FAIR. Your group has put out radio ads around the country against the amnesty bill that's being debated right now in Congress. Why?
Well, we oppose amnesty because it's more than simply forgiving of somebody who's broken our laws. It's actually forgiving them and then giving them a reward. And the reward is that they get to stay in the country that they didn't respect enough to come here legally in the first place. But before we go any further than that, I want to go back to Douglas on the border for a minute and sort of respond to some things Ms. Garcia has said. First of all, it's not immigrants who are dying. It's illegal aliens, and it's important that we make the distinction between those who come to our country legally and those who sneak into our country illegally, and that's who we're trying to stop at the border. The National Guard is on the border, not an attempt to militarize the border, but simply to build this fence, to continue to build this fence, so that the illegal aliens won't be able to sneak across the border in Douglas, in Naco, and continue to do that. Now, it is a problem in Douglas, which is in Cochise County, because this year it's expected that 3 million illegal aliens will sneak across the border in Cochise County. And the drug trafficking is so bad that almost the entire state of Arizona is now a high-intensity drug trafficking area. And it's so bad that the sheriff of Cochise County has sent a letter to the governor of Arizona, Jane Hull, asking her to send the National Guard to the border to help the Border Patrol protect the border from this invasion. Also, the Cochise County Board of Supervisors has also sent a letter to Jane Hull saying, please send the National Guard down to assist the Border Patrol to stop these illegal aliens from crossing the border. So it's important to understand the situation on the border. These people are not immigrants. They are illegal aliens. And with them come drug traffickers and criminals that add to our problem. The reason we have to build more prisons is 30% of our prison population nationwide is foreign-born. So what we need to do is to look to take care of this country and defend the border, which is what any reasonable country in the world would do. And that's the reason why you're seeing these calls for help along the border.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Father Robert Carney, who is a parish priest in Douglas, Arizona, the number one border crossing spot on the U.S.-Mexico border. Our guest, Rick Altman from the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Isabel Garcia with the Pima County Legal Defender's Office, speaking to us from Tucson. After that, we're going to be talking about an international U.N. conference that's taking place where a global treaty is being negotiated around some of the most toxic chemicals in the world, the Dirty Dozen chemicals seeping into the ground, water, and air. We'll be talking with environmentalists from Louisiana to the Philippines. And then we're going to take on the issue of mad cow disease, which has once again riled up Europe, and we'll be looking at whether it can happen here. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as Congress right now debates the issue of undocumented immigrants. We're talking to Isabel Garcia of the Pima County Legal Defender's Office in Tucson, Rick Altman, the Western Field Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and now Father Robert Carney, parish priest in Douglas, Arizona. I just wanted to start off, Father Robert Carney, by you responding to Rick Altman's distinction between immigrants who are dying and making the clarification that, no, these are illegal aliens.
I am still stunned by that because I see the faces of not illegal aliens, but I see the faces of women, terrified children, men, only seeking to survive, in effect. They have faced land disputes in their own country, economically depressed areas, drought, whatever might be going on. The reasons that people are leaving their home is not because they want to come north to take advantage of a system. The deaths along the border must be made known to the American public that we're a small town under 18,000, and I have seen more death here in this town than I've ever witnessed anywhere I've been, and it is. Because of INS policy to bottleneck this area by closing off San Diego and closing off in Texas, that has caused this great influx of people coming through the Douglas area. That was planned years ago, and I think it was also in that planning, I believe, now that there was an awareness that people would die in this somewhat desolate area, very difficult passage through very dry, and during the summer, many died during the summer, and now many are dying in the winter. The nights are bitter down here.
What about the special incident response team, presumably responding to rock throwing against Border Patrol agents? The team instructed to fire off explosives into the Mexican side of the border and to use stun gun technology against rock throwers.
It's an immediate, very quick escalation of the militarization along our border. I see similarities in that are taking place in other parts of the world where high-tech weapons and other kinds of techniques are used against people. Throwing rocks, it can be dangerous. Somebody's going to be hurt. But I believe that throwing explosive devices into our neighboring country will cause much, much more violence along the border.
Why do you suppose when Congress is considering amnesty, presumably admitting to a shortage in cheap labor, is the wall, the border, being extended and militarized?
I think that as far as the Catholic Church, its social justice teachings, we ask caution about skilled labor being allowed that amnesty, and forgetting about the campesino, the farm worker, those who are the least seen and I think the least addressed, people who come from nothing, they and then have nothing when they arrive, but have a tremendously high work ethic. Every person I have met, literally in 6 years, every person I have met has said to me in some form or another, I want to be reunited with my family, and all I want to do is get back to work. And I see the faces of people who are facing starvation and facing hostile paramilitary control in their own country, some of which that this nation has supported and been the cause of through training such as the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. We have a responsibility, I believe, to these people.
Rick Altman, can you respond to that, of the Federation for American Immigration Reform?
Well, I've also seen the people that have come across. I've been there when they've been apprehended, and they're certainly sympathetic, but they're not starving, and it's important that we don't overstate the situation here. In terms of death, obviously the deaths are... It's sad to have deaths at the border, but the fact is these people have made their own decision to try to sneak into our country. And if they've made the decision to come through very inhospitable areas, the final responsibility does lie with them. And it's a shame to have deaths, and I just have to say that the Border Patrol has gone out of its way to go out and rescue many people. Far more people have been rescued than have died. And I'm not sure of the number, but I think over the last 10 years, the number is around a couple hundred people. And I'm not trying to minimize that number. I'm just trying to say let's not overstate that number and make it sound like dozens of people are dying in Douglas every day, because it's simply not true. Now, these people are sympathetic. They do come from areas that... that are really terrible conditions. I have to tell you, if I lived in some of these terrible conditions, I'd try to get here too, especially if every signal I got from the U.S. government was, come on. Every time the U.S. government talks about amnesty, it encourages people to come to our borders for the exact reason that you named, so that business can have cheap labor in America, and this cheap labor holds down wages, and it hurts Americans. So what we need to do is to sort of look at the whole picture. Let's just not look at these illegal aliens. Let's not look at the terrible consequences in third world countries. But let's look at the consequences everywhere, including the consequences in our country, where I live in a state in California where there's more poverty in California today than there was 10 years ago because of all the immigrant labor that has come in and held down wages. We need to look at the whole picture. Let's not overstate the problem. Let's help who we can help, but let's be sure that we have an immigration policy that benefits America and Americans first, and not to the expense of American workers.
Isabel Garcia, I give you the last word as
yes.
You prepare for this border summit that's taking place in Tucson this weekend.
Yes, we are having a border summit the 8th, 9th, and 10th in Tucson. so we can deal with it in a holistic way. However, I find it just absolutely unconscionable that Mr. Altman can so easily dismiss the over 400 people that have died, over 100 in the Tucson sector alone this past year, and for him to simply attempt to say it's okay because they're not immigrants, they're illegal aliens, I find absolutely unconscionable. They've been nothing but a immigrants as a whole have been nothing but a windfall to this community, for this country. They have built the West. If every undocumented immigrant that he calls illegal alien were deported today, all of the major cities in this country would fall apart in one day. And I agree with you. It's hypocritical. We need their labor. The state of Iowa is doing full-page ads to have immigrants come into their community because they need their hard work. And yet we hypocritically, in an unconscionable fashion, we set up this obstacle, deadly course for them to have to come through and risk their life before they can get a job. I find it unconscionable that he says we have to defend our border when, as Father Carney states, these are people that are in fact starving. He's not telling you the truth when he says it's not so bad. It's absolutely a lie, because people are in fact dying, attempting to get here, and it's unconscionable that we have a policy that is directly causing them to die. Yes, they sneak across because of our immigration laws. That's exactly why. And we as a country should be more conscious of human life. We have already allowed the military to have become involved in this situation through the Joint Task Force 6. We have soldiers at the border, and all for immigrants who have done nothing but help our community. And until we deal with the issues in a holistic way, which we plan to do at this summit to deal with...
Can you give us the number of the Arizona Border Rights Project if people want to get in touch
with
them?
Yes, our number, and I'm actually the director of the legal Pima County Legal Defenders, but I'm with Derechos Humanos. Our phone number in Tucson is 520-770-1373.
That's
the Border Summit.
520-770-1377.
And we will deal with
137. Can you just repeat the number? 770-1373. And Rick Altman of the Federation of American Immigration Reform, your contact information.
You can go to our website at www.fairus.org. And you can be updated as to what is going on the border and why it's important that we defend the border and not allow our country to become the destination for everybody in the world who wants to come here. And I just want to argue with the fact they do not have the right to come here. We have the right to defend our country.
Well,
go to the FAIR website and you'll get more additional information on this area in Arizona that the Border Patrol calls ground zero for illegal immigration into our country.
Rick Altman of Federation for American Immigration Reform and Father Robert Carney, thanks for joining us, parish priest in Douglas, Arizona. As we move on now to another national and international issue, the conference is taking place right now in South Africa. Activists from around the world have gathered in Johannesburg, where 120 nations are negotiating the terms of a global treaty that could ban some of the most toxic chemicals in the world. Some of these activists come from some of the world's toxic hotspots, where cancer rates have soared because of environmental pollution. The treaty focuses on 12 of the deadliest chemicals, including PCBs, pesticides such as DDT, and industrial byproducts such as dioxin. These dirty dozen chemicals seep into the ground, water, and air, threatening babies through breast milk and Arctic indigenous people through flesh of the fatty fish that they eat. The delegates began 6 days of negotiations yesterday in the fifth and final summit planned before a treaty is signed in May in Stockholm, Sweden. The activists are particularly critical of the U.S., accusing its representatives of undermining the treaty. Among those who are meeting are residents of an area of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley, home to the largest number of vinyl production plants in the United States. The plants release 8 million pounds of pollution annually, the largest concentration located in predominantly African-American communities. We're joined on the telephone from South Africa by David Prince, an environmental activist from Mossville, Louisiana, whose entire family has fallen ill from the effects of several vinyl plastics factories that operate in his community. Welcome to Democracy Now! From South Africa, David Prince.
Thank you very much.
It's
appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you being on. I should tell our listeners, all of our guests are on cell phones in South Africa. So I hope this segment goes well. But we think that the importance of the information was important enough to risk this. Tell us what's happening in your community and why you're in South Africa.
Oh, yes. The reason I'm here in Johannesburg is basically a twofold reason. One is to relate to the world the devastating effects of dioxins, poisons that have caused my entire family many, many, many ailments, and many other people in my community of Mossville, Louisiana. And a second reason why I am here is to urge our government, the United States, to play a positive role in signing a treaty that will ultimately eliminate dioxin. Now, my community lives with PVC production plants that routinely emit toxic pollutants that are affecting our health. When I last attended such a meeting of this type in Geneva, Switzerland, about a year and a half ago, my wife, Diane, was in remission from ovarian cancer. Today, her cancer has returned and now is undergoing a regimen of chemotherapy. Today, her cancer seemed to not to be slowing down as it did before. My daughter, my oldest daughter, who suffers from endometriosis, has been told that she will need to undergo a hysterectomy, thereby eliminating any chance for childbearing. And that's very devastating to my wife and I. My oldest son, who is now doing well off this operation from a deviated septum, but my youngest daughter, she still suffers from bleeding kidneys. And my youngest son, of course, suffers from bleeding ulcers. All of the above ailments that I just mentioned are principally due to the fact that our local, state, and federal governments are unable or unwilling to stop chemical industries such as Condea Vista and PPG from dumping massive amounts of pollutants such as PVC production chemicals into the air we breathe on a daily basis.
Let me ask Rick Hine of the Greenpeace Toxics Campaign.
To have them stop, seem like all of our efforts fall on deaf ears.
Rick Hine,
now,
David,
in the United States, yes?
Go ahead.
I cannot hear you.
I just want to bring Rick Hind into the conversation, the Greenpeace Toxics Campaign legislative director, also speaking to us from Johannesburg, and ask how you think an international global treaty can affect David Prince, his family, his community in Mossville, Louisiana.
Well, right now, the way we're going, we're a little pessimistic about that, because the only thing that may be more dangerous than these chemicals is the U.S. efforts to sabotage or at least try to weaken the treaty and render it useless. But if the treaty were to be embraced as a strong phase-out of toxic materials like dioxin and furans and PCBs, then we would see a mandate as well as proposals for solutions or alternatives that every country would be required to move ahead on. This is a legally binding instrument to
phase out these chemicals once and for all. Obviously, many of them will not be done overnight. And that means that the U.S., for the first time, would have to look into ways to avoid dioxin, not just reduce it or minimize it, which is all the U.S. administration is willing to do right now.
What role do lobbyists play in the U.S. position in this global treaty?
Well, we were actually trying to get a chemical industry spokesman on the show here, and I just found somebody, but it was a little too late to book him on your show. There's many representatives of the chemical industry, both from Europe, Canada, and the U.S., who play a key role in formulating U.S.'s position. And then the U.S. Organizes other industrial countries like Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada in a bloc that is a minority but nevertheless powerful alliance to, in the case of earlier this year, even intimidate other countries. For example, the U.S. sent a threatening memo to the European Union suggesting that the POP treaty would collapse unless the EU backed off of strong positions on dioxin and other issues. So another big issue here, for example, is funding for the developing world. Small countries don't have the resources of New York State, let alone the U.S. EPA. And so these countries are asking for some assistance in implementing these phase-out strategies. For most of them, they will not need much because they either will be switching to cheaper, safer things, or they'll be avoiding the kinds of expensive pollution control devices like scrubbers on smokestacks that the U.S. has been essentially using as a substitute for pollution prevention.
We're going to... So, the major companies that are lobbying there?
Well, these chemical industry trade associations represent the major... companies that are polluting in David Prince's community, such as PPG and Dow Chemical or Borden Chemical and so forth. They also represent, you know, the same companies, the multinationals, Dow, DuPont, Union Carbide, globally in Europe and elsewhere. And as you'll hear, these companies were and are responsible for contamination around the globe, the Philippines, India, China, Japan, and so forth.
Speaking of the Philippines,
yeah.
we want to bring in Von Hernandez for a last comment. We're going to make the break a bit late today because everyone's on cell phone. We don't want to lose him. Greenpeace Southeast Asia Philippines activist in Johannesburg now. Also for the UN conference on these toxins, a global treaty that could ban some of the most toxic chemicals in the world. You've been dealing with the PCBs coming from deserted U.S. military bases in the Philippines. Can you describe these sites? Von Hernandez.
Yes, we are talking here of thank you. We are talking here of two former U.S. bases, which used to be the largest facilities outside the United States. And both bases, Clark and Subic, have been closed down years ago and are now under the Philippine government, who has converted them into economic flagship centers. Unfortunately, when the U.S. government left, they also left behind toxic legacy, and we are now finding out that many sites within the former bases are actually contaminated not only with PCBs but also other persistent pollutants, pesticides like DDT, chlorine, and other toxic substances. And we are here in Johannesburg because we want to highlight each of these two bases as actually global hotspots. If you consider that right now, existing studies that we have point to a serious problem in both areas, and you have communities now suffering from the effects of these chemicals left behind by the U.S. military.
Von Hernandez, I want to thank you for joining us. I wish you could be clearer, but it's quite incredible that we can speak to you all in South Africa on your cell phones as you deal with this UN conference dealing with some of the most toxic chemicals known to humankind. Von Hernandez of Greenpeace Southeast Asia. The website of Greenpeace is www.greenpeace.org. When we come back from our break, we're going to deal with another international health issue, and it's the issue of mad cow disease from Europe to the United States. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And we're going to turn now to the issue of mad cow disease. After a tumultuous session, the European Union, alarmed at the spread of mad cow disease from Britain to Spain, France, and Germany, announced the slaughter of all untested cows older than 30 months. It also imposed a total ban on feeding animal parts to livestock. The EU fears a repeat of Britain's experience, where an epidemic of mad cow disease devastated the country's beef industry, triggering the slaughter of 200,000 cows. The cows, natural herbivores, became infected through feed containing animal parts. More than 70 people are known to have contracted the always fatal neurological disease, presumably after eating beef. But since the incubation period for the human form of mad cow disease can be decades long, no one knows how many people have been infected but have yet to show symptoms. We're going to go first to Deborah McKenzie, who's the Europe correspondent for the New Scientist magazine, speaking to us from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, speaking to us from Brussels. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us about the European Union decision?
Well, what happened was that a lot of people, a lot of countries, governments on the continent of Europe were sort of thinking of mad cow disease as being largely a British problem. There are a number of countries here that that had a few cases here and there, but by and large, everybody was sort of hoping it would sort of more or less remain confined to Britain, and several countries weren't doing a very good job of looking for it. What happened was that the French suddenly decided to go out and actually look very carefully for mad cow disease. They were fairly confident they wouldn't find very much. And in fact, they found about, you know, 10 times as much as they were expecting to, which scared them. And then, lo and behold, the first cases turn up in Germany and Spain. Well, some people have been predicting this for a long time, but the governments were trying to ignore it. They couldn't ignore it any longer. And what happened was, well, there was a lot of consumer panic, and everyone got together and decided that they had better do something drastic.
We're also joined on the phone by Gary Weber, who is the Executive Director of Regulator Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. An EU report listed the U.S. as a country where mad cow disease could not be ruled out. Is U.S. beef safe? Gary Weber?
Yes, it is. In fact, as was just mentioned, the concerns about countries of Europe, we've monitored that for some time, and actually in 97, supported USDA, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, to put additional restrictions on the export of cattle, beef, and beef products from all European countries because our intelligence was providing us with insights that they may have a problem there. So we've continued to take some very aggressive steps in the United States to protect the health of the cattle herd and, of course, the health of our consumers.
John Stauber also joins us, who's co-author of Mad Cow USA. Are you as confident about the U.S. beef supply?
No, I'm not at all. And I think that Gary's words highlight a problem with the attitude in the United States that Deborah referred to. The livestock industry in the United States, the U.S. government, and the EU all shared the same myopic view of this problem, saying that the problem is British mad cow disease and it can't happen here. What I'm really concerned about in the United States isn't BSE per se. That's a very specific strain that's broken out in Britain and spread to Europe. No surprise, since in 1988, when Britain began banning contaminated feed, it exported that feed to Europe. And in our book, Mad Cow USA, we certainly predicted what's happening in Europe. But what's happening in the United States that is very frightening is that we have our own forms of mad cow-type diseases. We have TSC diseases, which these are called in scrapie in the U.S., and most frighteningly, we have a type of mad deer and mad elk disease that's now at epidemic levels in western states. And in just the last 2 years, at least two young hunters under the age of 30 have come down with the human equivalent of mad cow disease, and they may have picked that up from deer and elk. Now, we have a huge rendering industry in the United States, and we have the most lax laws regarding this practice of animal cannibalism, feeding slaughterhouse waste back to animals. And in the United States, it is legal to feed deer and elk and sheep infected with mad cow type diseases to pigs, for instance, and it's legal then to feed pig slaughterhouse waste to cows. So we have huge loopholes in our regulations here, and all this focus on British mad cow disease is hiding the fact that we have U.S. types of mad cow disease that very well could already be spreading through our livestock.
Gary Weber of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Well, we put in place some very stringent bans on the feeding of all meat and bone meal to cattle, and except, as John is mentioning, from poultry byproducts to pork byproducts, which are still allowed. Fortunately, we don't think that there is any science to suggest that that kind of backdoor route is realistic. There's no evidence to support that. But also, we continue to monitor the United States for the presence of diseases in cattle. We have doubled our submissions of brain samples. We're using the best technology. It's a little bit slow, but we have a far more sensitive set of tests than they're using in Europe based on immunohistochemistry. And we continue to really encourage very aggressive surveillance of these diseases. And relative to chronic wasting disease, it really is limited to a few counties in a few states in the West, and we have been very aggressive in supporting the elk industry and taking very stringent action against that. And we have been supporting research to see if that disease is transmissible to cattle and other animals.
Let's go back to Deborah McKenzie in Brussels for a minute, who's been following the European Union negotiations. The second major measure adopted by the EU is a feed ban. Currently, all EU countries except the UK feed meat and bone meal from slaughtered animals, including cattle, to pigs, chickens, and fish. Explain the ban and how the U.S. policy differs.
Actually, could I do that in a minute? I'd like to respond to a couple of points the last speaker made. First of all, you do not have a more sensitive test in the United States. Secondly, you've tested a very, very small proportion of your livestock. You're doing what Germany did. You're not looking very hard for prion-type diseases in general. And thirdly, you say that there's no science to suggest that, you know, CWD, for example, chronic wasting disease in elk, could possibly get into livestock through pigs or something. There's no science to suggest it because there's no science that's been done. The British made that mistake for many years. They said there's no evidence. I quote a very famous line that is often quoted in respect to these diseases. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. I would like to see somebody feed some mad elk to some pigs and then look for infectivity. Back to your question about feeding MBM, rendered animals, to livestock, the same situation prevails in Europe. On the continent, they have been allowing the feeding of ground-up cattle to pigs and chickens. That has now been banned, largely because they were scared that some of that feed was getting back to cows, and that was how the disease was still spreading in cows. In fact, to my mind, what's very frightening about that is precisely what was suggested a minute ago might be the case for chronic wasting disease in elk, in that you feed something to a pig, you don't know if that pig is then infectious because it's actually never been tested. And on the continent of Europe, where we now know that there is a great deal more mad cow disease than we were admitting in the past, we know for sure now that we've been feeding rendered mad cows to pigs and chickens, and no one's actually ever done the experiment of feeding a mad cow to a pig and then grinding up tissue from that pig and giving it to a sensitive species and seeing whether that pig is infectious. Now, it's the absence of evidence that frightens me.
That's Deborah McKenzie, Europe correspondent for the New Scientist magazine. Gary Weber, your response. And also, is the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the national arm of the group that has sued Oprah Winfrey, challenging her for saying she didn't want to eat hamburgers?
No, we never sued Oprah Winfrey. I happen to have been on the show, but a group of cattle producers independently sued her for some comments that a gentleman made on the show, but we were not involved with, and I was the participant in that event.
Were you opposed to that suit?
I felt that she was very fair about how she had offered us an opportunity to come on the show a second time live to state the facts that we've been very aggressive here. And
I just raise it because I think there's not a lot of discussion in this country about the issues of mad cow and the whole meat industry. And I think that suit helps, even though she won, to squelch people from engaging in discussion because they're afraid they don't have the resources of Oprah to handle these multimillion dollar corporate lawsuits.
Back to the question of our testing. Actually, I would differ on our rigor of our surveillance program. We're actually targeting animals over 30 months of age, which are the animals that would be at risk. We're targeting animals that have symptoms of neurological disease. We're using immunohistochemistry technology, which is more sensitive than the prionics test, for instance, that the Swiss are using. We know the government is looking at even more sensitive tests, which we support. So I think that we have a very good system. The OIE, the international body that monitors animal health globally associated with the WTO, has referenced our system as at least adequate, and we're buttressing it even more. Relative to chronic wasting disease, we actually have research underway where they have injected into the brains of cattle the brains from infected elk. So those studies are underway.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. But do you feed infected elk to cattle, or do you feed them to pigs?
Well, number one, and there isn't much of an elk industry in the United States, and it's not like the cattle industry, and these animals are not going into rendering systems. The only way they could be is if they were roadkill, possibly, and I think by and large that's ended. So they're not in an area where that would really happen, but certainly that's a good question to monitor that.
You know, it's really...
John Stauber.
This is John Stauber, co-author of Mad Cow USA, a book that came out 3 years ago, and it's really painful to listen to Gary Weber be so smooth and disingenuous here. In fact, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association has been a strong defender and supporter.
We have about 20 seconds.
Of the food disparagement laws. And in fact, there has been media censorship of this issue in the U.S. And in fact, mad deer and mad elk disease are spreading across the U.S. through trafficking and game farms. And our regulations here are absolutely inadequate to the task of preventing a mad cow type disease from breaking out in the United States.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up. John Stauber, co-author of Mad Cow USA, Gary Weber of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and Deborah McKenzie joining us from Brussels, Europe correspondent for the New Scientist magazine. Thanks for being with us.
looked out my door. I could tell my milk cow, I could tell by the way she looks.
And Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Terry Allen. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Our website, democracynow.org. From the studios at WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.